what does a godly church leader look like? I don't mean old or young. I don't mean clean shaven or facial hair. I don't mean dressed in a suit and tie or dressed with an open collar. But what does a godly church leader look like? How does he act within the church? What does he think of his own abilities? How does he respond when rebuked? Last week we started this discussion as we looked at 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and I brought out for you from that chapter four principles about God's servant leaders. Let me remind you of those. God's servant leader shows forbearance, yet administers discipline. God's servant leader uses spiritual weapons, the Word of God. God's servant leader aims to build up the body both locally and to the end of the earth. And God's servant leader is called by God and commended by God. Today we move into 2 Corinthians chapter 11, where Paul continues and deepens this discussion. We'll see that he contends that your very salvation may depend on the leaders you choose to follow. We'll see that the same characteristics Paul condemns are common in many church leaders today. And we'll see that Paul gives us two additional descriptions of church leaders that are exceptionally valuable given today's church culture. Now, 2 Corinthians 11 is a long and somewhat complicated passage. So before we draw out these principles, I think it's helpful for you to see the flow of Paul's argument throughout the chapter. So let's go through the text together. I'll show you the major sections, make just a few comments on each of those major sections, and then after we go through the entire text, I want to draw out three principles from the chapter as a whole. Now remember the situation. Paul has planted this church. Many of the believers in Corinth became believers as a direct result of Paul's ministry, but opposition has sprung up within the church. There are people who call themselves apostles, call themselves the true apostles, and say Paul is no apostle whatsoever. They present letters of recommendation. They say how important they are. They say that Paul suffers too much, that Paul changes his mind too much, that Paul is not really much of a speaker. And for all these reasons, Paul is no genuine apostle, while they themselves are the true thing. So keep that in mind as we go through the chapter. Look at the first four verses, 2 Corinthians 11, 1-4. I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me. I feel a divine jealousy for you, for I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it readily enough. We could entitle these four verses, "Who you listen to matters." These people seem to listen to Paul initially, but Paul says they're in danger of being led astray, even as Eve was led astray by the serpent. These other teachers are not just preaching the gospel in a different way than Paul, but they are preaching, says Paul, a different gospel. A different way of being right with God. They're preaching a different Jesus, a different spirit. And thus to follow them is very dangerous. And yet, the Corinthians are tolerating these false teachers in their midst. Well, in the next 11 verses, 5 to 15, Paul addresses two of the charges that these false apostles have given against him. First, the charge that he's not much of a public speaker in verses 5 and 6. And then, in verses 7 to 15, they charge him with the fact that he did not take any money from the Corinthians. They seem to be saying, you get what you pay for. You didn't pay much for Paul to be among you, and you're not getting much from him. So first of all, verses 5 and 6, Paul says, for I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostle. Even if I am unskilled in speaking, I am not so in knowledge. Indeed, in every way we have made this plain to you in all things. I read verse 5 from the New American Standard rather than the English Standard because of the way it translates that the last few words. Most eminent apostles. If you're looking at the NIV or the English Standard, you have super apostles, and the NIV even puts that in quotation marks. The translator is thinking that Paul is referring there to his opponents, saying that he considers himself not in the least inferior to them. But it makes more sense in the flow of Paul's argument, the way the New American Standard translates it, and with the Greek it can easily be translated either way, to think that Paul is referring at the end of verse 5 not to his opponents, but to Peter and to the other apostles in Jerusalem. Paul is saying, I may not be much of a speaker by Greek rhetorical standards, but I know what I'm talking about. I am preaching the apostolic doctrine, what is the foundation of the church. I am an apostle. I'm not inferior to Peter, to James, to John, the others. I'm not speaking by the standards of Greek rhetoric, but I am giving you knowledge. I have made this knowledge plain to you, the true gospel. So what Paul is emphasizing is that rhetoric is not important. The way one speaks is not important. Truth is important. And Paul says, I've given you the most important truth in the world, and you're in danger of losing it. So hold on to it. Well, the second charge against Paul, that they paid him nothing, Paul spends a considerable amount of time looking at, verses 7 to 15. Or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted? Because I preach God's gospel to you free of charge. I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrain and will refrain from burdening you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. And what I do, I will continue to do in order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission, they work on the same terms as we do. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. So you see, his opponents are saying, Paul didn't even charge you Corinthians anything. He didn't even take up a collection. He knows his words aren't worth anything. And Paul responds in several ways. Verse 7, he says,
He did it to exalt the Corinthians. Verse 9, he did it so as not to be a burden on them. Verse 11, he did it as evidence of his love for them. And then in verse 12 to 15, I think the way to understand these verses is that he continues to do this. He continues not to charge them in order to distinguish himself from the false teachers. They disguise themselves as apostles, just as Satan disguises himself as an angel. And their end is hell. So at this point, Paul has said, who you listen to matters, verses 1 to 4. And then he's dealt with two objections. First, that he's not a public speaker, but he has given them the true apostolic knowledge. And then secondly, that yes, the charge that he did not make any money from them is true, but this was the way he served them. It was an expression of his love. Now, having dealt with those two objections, now Paul says, reluctantly, he's going to use the technique that his opponents use of exalting themselves. He explains what he's going to do now. And verses 16 to 21 give the foundation for why Paul then says what he says in 22 and 23. So 16 to 21. I repeat, let no one think me foolish, but even if you do, accept me as a fool, so that I too may boast a little. What I am saying with this boastful confidence, I say not with the Lord's authority, but as a fool. Since many boast according to the flesh, I too will boast. For you gladly bear with fools, being wise yourselves. For you bear it if someone makes slaves of you, or devours you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face. To my shame, I must say we were too weak for that. But whatever anyone else dares to boast of, I am speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast of that. Now Paul is saying here that his opponents are very foolish to have such a boastful confidence, to be proud of themselves in a worldly sense. But then he says, you know, please, if you're going to listen to these guys boast, well then, listen to me boast foolishly in the same way. You're listening to these false apostles, to what they boast about. Well, could I boast in that way? It's foolish, but sure, I'll do it. Consider me a fool and listen to my boast. These other opponents have enslaved the Corinthians, says Paul. These other opponents are working to their harm. At least listen to my foolishness, since I'm working for your good. And so then in verses 22 and the first half of 23, he gives his foolish boasting. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they offspring of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I am a better one. I'm talking like a madman. Do you see what Paul is boasting in and why it is so foolish? Two things. First, boasting in his ancestors. Boasting in his ancestors. That's what these Corinthian apostles were doing, evidently. They were saying, we are from the seed of Abraham, so we have things to teach you Gentiles. Well, John the Baptist dealt with that very effectively in his ministry, didn't he? In Matthew 3:9, he, speaking to the Jewish leader, says this, do not presume to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father, for I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children of Abraham. So the appeal to ancestry is pure foolishness, and Paul knows it, but he at least makes the point, if you're going to follow after someone because they're a child of Abraham, it's a stupid reason to follow someone, but you might as well follow me as follow these other folks. But then the second foolish boast is to say that Paul is a better servant of Christ than his opponents. Have you heard people get into an argument about which of two pastors is better? It's pretty foolish. It's pretty foolish. And Paul knows that. And he addresses that in 1 Corinthians in chapters 3 and 4 when he talks about those who are saying, I follow Apollos, I follow Paul, I follow Peter. That's all foolishness. But now look how Paul argues to say that he is a better servant. How do you think Paul's opponents argued that they were better servants of Christ? They probably argued and said, well, you know, we have the in-depth secret knowledge that Paul doesn't have. We can show you the way to live out the Christian life. Paul doesn't know that. We can show you how to be a success in this world, and Paul's very lifestyle shows that he's a failure. Remember, they've been accusing Paul of not being an apostle because he suffers. And now look how Paul justifies the fact that he is a better servant of Christ than they are. He goes directly to his suffering. So Paul's foolish boasting ends right there in the middle of verse 23. Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one. I'm talking like a madman. So he stops talking like a madman. And now he shows the actual evidence that he is an apostle, and it is his suffering. So the evidence that he is a servant of Christ does not come from his pedigree. And it does not come from his personal accomplishments. Instead, the evidence that Paul is a better servant of Christ comes from things that look like failures in the eyes of these pseudo-apostles and in the eyes of the world. So let's read verses 23 to 33 now. This is the genuine evidence of Paul's apostleship. He is no longer talking like a fool. I am talking like a madman, and now his genuine evidence. With far greater labors, far more imprisonment, with countless beatings, often near death, 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one, 3 times I was beaten with rods, 1 I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked, 1 night and 1 day I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there is a daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak, and I am not weak? Who is made to fall, and I am not indignant? If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, He who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. At Damascus, the governor under King Aretas was guarding the city of Damascus in order to seize me, but I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped his hand. So Paul has been almost killed many times. He's been imprisoned. He's been shipwrecked. Hardly a day goes by when he's not in danger of some sort. He's gone without food. He's been exposed to the elements. And what he considers the greatest pressure of all, his anxiety for his spiritual children. He's weak. He emphasizes his weakness here. And indeed, he discusses this incident in Damascus, I believe, to show that from the very beginning of his life in Christ, it's been a life of weakness. Remember, Paul was on the road to Damascus when Jesus met him and changed his heart. And then he goes to Damascus, and when he first begins to speak of the truth of Jesus Christ and to argue from the Old Testament that Jesus is the Christ, he is threatened, and he escapes in this ignominious way, being let down in a basket from a window in the wall. Paul says, that's how my Christian life began. In weakness. And this is a marked contrast to the slick, professional, and successful false apostles. And it's a marked contrast to the slick, professional, and successful false teachers of our day. Well, that's the overview of the chapter. That's how Paul structures the chapter and how he makes his point. What are the principles that we can bring out from this? First, God's servant leaders know they are weak and incompetent on their own. God's servant leaders know they are weak and incompetent on their own. Paul knows his weakness. It's apparent to him all the time, isn't it? He made this point back in chapter 3, verse 5. Not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God. And this is characteristic of all of God's true servants over all the ages. William Carey. Who is William Carey? The father of modern missions, often so called. William Carey went to India in 1792 and struggled just to survive for many years. And yet, by the end of his life, he had founded a huge missionary movement. He had been involved in Bible translation into dozens of languages. He himself became a linguistic marvel and a scholar of to whom no one else could compare. And so he's one of our heroes of the faith today. And this is what William Carey said to his nephew one day. If after my removal, meaning removal to heaven, if after my removal anyone should think it worth his while to write my life, I will give you a criterion by which you may judge of its correctness. If he gives me credit for being a plotter, he will describe me justly. Anything beyond this will be too much. I can plod. I can persevere in any definite pursuit. To this I owe everything. So our hero, a plotter, he realized his weakness. He realized that his task was to be faithful to the task that God gave him minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day. And that's what William Carey did. He didn't think of himself as particularly important. He didn't try to convince other people that he was a super apostle. He just did the task that God gave him each day. And in doing that, he accomplished tremendous things by God's power in his life. William Carey. John Piper. From the beginning of John's ministry, he's always used a little acronym, APTAT, before he speaks and even when he wakes up every day. I want to read you a little excerpt from a sermon he preached in 1983 when he had just been at Bethlehem less than 3 years. So he talks about what does aptat, A-P-T-A-T, mean? And why does he do this before every sermon? A, I acknowledge that apart from Christ, I can do nothing of eternal value. I acknowledge with Paul in Romans 7:18, in me that is in my flesh dwells no good thing. Acknowledge. P, I pray. I pray with Paul in 1 Thessalonians 3:12 that Christ would make me abound in love. I pray that grace might reign in my life through righteousness. I pray that God would produce in me the obedience he demands. T, I trust. This is the key. The ongoing work of the Spirit to enable us to love as we ought happens only as we trust the promises of God. So by faith, I lay hold on a promise like Isaiah 41:10. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my victorious right hand. I trust that as I act, it will not be I, but the power of Christ in me and me only clinging to him in faith. A-P-T-A. A, I act in obedience to God's word. But oh, what a world of difference now between such an act and what Paul calls works of the law. The acknowledgement that I am helpless, the prayer for divine enablement, the trust that Christ himself is my help and strength, these transform the act so that it is the fruit of the Spirit and not a work of the flesh in me. T, finally, when the deed is done, I thank God for whatever good may have come of my life. I thank him for conquering, at least in some measure, my selfishness and pride. And I give him the glory. Aptat. I commend that to you. It's something I try to focus on every Sunday morning, sitting here before preaching. It is so vital for us each to acknowledge that we are weak, and especially so for church leaders to acknowledge their weakness, that all their strength, that all their effectiveness is God flowing through them. And if God's power is not flowing through them, then there's nothing of eternal value that is accomplished. God's servant leaders know of their weakness. Second, God's servant leaders not only know their weakness, but they boast in that weakness. They do not hide it. Verse 30, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. What is our natural tendency? If there's some aspect of our character that is weak, what is our tendency? Do we go around talking about that? We will tend to hide it, won't we? We will tend to pretend that it's not there. That's naturally what we will do. We will try to be strong and have our act together, try to pretend that we know exactly what we are to be doing. That's not the characteristic of a godly servant leader. Paul boasts in his weakness. Why? Paul boasts in his weakness so that God would be glorified. So that it becomes very clear that whatever is accomplished through him, God gets the glory, not Paul. And if we are boasting in our strength, or if we are failing to acknowledge our weakness publicly, then we are taking glory from God and giving it to ourselves. This is a huge temptation when people ask me about this church. How is your church doing? You must face the same thing. When people ask you, how's that church plant doing? And the temptation is to begin to say, well, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened. And great things, great things are going on in the Zion God Community Church. Well, great things are going on. They are. But I've tried to discipline myself to always say something like this: God is bringing together a dedicated group of believers there at the Zion God Community Church, and it's a pleasure to watch Him do it. Somehow we have to be very conscious of the temptation to take credit to ourselves, or to take credit to our leaders, or to take credit for us as a body. All glory needs to go to God and not to us. Now, when our personal weakness is a sin, the test is especially important. In our family devotion times the last 2 weeks, we've been going through Proverbs. Let me read you a few Proverbs about how we should respond to reproof and rebuke. 9:8, do not reprove a scoffer or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man and he will love you. Like a gold ring or an ornament of gold is a wise reprover to a listening ear. That's 25:12. 12:1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid. Pretty succinct. This is true for all of us, but it's especially true for church leaders, pastors, elders. And many church leaders do not want to be reproved. They take offense if someone from their congregation, not even a leader, how can that person come up and speak to me, the pastor, about something in my life? Many take offense. 1 Timothy 5:20, after saying that you have to be careful about not accepting any charge against an elder that might come up from an individual, but when it's verified by two or three, Paul says in 1 Timothy 5:20, those elders who sin are to be rebuked publicly so that the others may take warning. A public sin requires a public rebuke. And that's something that every elder in this church will accept upon taking that office. That we are open to criticism and reproof. The criticism may not be well taken. Just because the criticism comes up doesn't mean it's true. But that we are open to scriptural reproof and rebuke. And we welcome it. We want that. I want that from you. God's servant leaders boast in their weakness and don't hide it. Finally, your salvation may depend on whom you follow. That seems like a very strong statement, but look back at verses 2 and 3. I feel a divine jealousy for you, for I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as a serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. These false teachers are compared to Satan in the garden. And as Eve listened to Satan, what happened? the fall of mankind.
So this is the danger of following a self-important leader. Even if there's not a readily apparent doctrinal problem. Some false teachers are easy to pick out because they're teaching wrong doctrine about the person of Jesus Christ or about the way of salvation. But others have more subtle doctrinal issues. And so the way to spot them is through other warning signs. The night before I left Massachusetts to go to Bethlehem to study there, I had a dream. And I woke up in the middle of the night after this dream. And the thought occurred to me, as crazy thoughts do in the middle of the night, what if you've given so much, you've left behind so much to go to Bethlehem and study, and what if you get there and you find out that Piper is just a fake? He's just able to preach and pretend, but you get there and you find out that when you see him face to face and you get to know him personally, he's just a fake. That kind of startled me in the middle of the night. I didn't sleep much for a while. Well, John is not a fake. But you know, in many ways, those people who are fakes are even more dangerous than those who have overtly clear false doctrine. Because they can suck us in and take us in and enslave us as these false teachers did in Corinth and lead us astray. What are some of the warning signs of false teachers? Let me briefly give you three. In addition to false doctrine, always examine people's doctrine, but in addition to false doctrine, what are some of the warning signs of these types of teachers who will lead us astray? Question to ask. On a controversial topic, does the teacher encourage you to search the scriptures and see if what he is saying is true? Or does he depend on his own authority and say, listen to me, I'm right? Is he encouraging you to go back to the scriptures and search them? Or is he establishing himself as the authority? Second, what kind of atmosphere is engendered in the church? Is an atmosphere engendered in the church in which others are telling you, don't challenge the Lord's anointed. Don't disagree with this leader that God set up over us. That's very, very dangerous. And then thirdly, how does the leader respond when confronted with sin? Does he say that he denies it when it's true? Or if he admits it, does he say, yes, I've sinned, but if you talk about this with anyone else, you're going to be guilty of gossip? That happens too. That happens a lot. In our vision statement, we wrote these words: our leaders are not lords. We value leaders who are servants, who are transparent, who are accountable, who are humble, who live a modest lifestyle, and who have a team approach to ministry. Thus, as we build up in the course of 2004, as we build up the leadership team at this church, we are bringing together a group of men
whose goal will be to get the congregation to search the Scriptures, not to agree with us. We will gather together a group of men who will carefully evaluate any appearance of sin in our lives and try to deal with even the appearance of sin. And should we fall into any public sin that comes to our knowledge, the public sins of any elder will be publicly rebuked. Salvation is at stake in who you listen to. Be careful who you listen to. Even when the person proclaims himself as a servant of Christ, as these false apostles in Corinth did, we must be careful who we listen to. Well, God's servant leaders. God's servant leaders know they are weak and incompetent on their own. God's servant leaders boast in weakness and don't hide it. And all of you, take care who you follow. In your own life, who are you following? Who are you following? Do you personally, leader or not a leader in the church, do you personally know and acknowledge your own weakness? Are you pretending with other believers here that everything's all right, that you've got your act together, when it's really not? It's okay to be weak. It's okay to be weak. That's why we have the church, so that we can love each other and build each other up. We don't have to pretend that we have our act together. We are to love each other and build each other up, knowing that we are all weak. Like Paul, you can admit your weakness and open yourself up to God to strengthen you through His people. This verse that John quoted in the passage, in the discussion of Aptat, let me read again, Isaiah 41:10. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, I will help you, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. That's our God. The one who takes us, weak as we are, sinful as we are, builds us up, makes us His agents, equips us to serve Him, keeps us humble by our weakness, and through us, and weak people like ourselves, and plotters like William Carey, will cover the earth with His glory as the waters cover the sea.